I hate to disappoint you. I was really going to, I was thinking seriously about volunteering for the talent show tonight. I thought I would do a Holden version of that old song. You probably heard it sung on old records. It has the melody from The Dance of the Hours, ta-da-da-da, no. Does it start out to his mother and father, some kid writing from camp? Well, I had quite a few lines. The only one, the stanza that sort of got worked out, but I thought either I was going to have too few or too many stanzas, but the one was, send me cookies, send me candy, send me anything that's handy, send me white bread, make it big chunks, and a recipe for frying little chipmunks. Aren't you lucky that I'm not going to appear on that? Well, from that to serious business. We are starting now a short series. You know, that's sort of like the picnic that starts in an area, and they have the first annual picnic with the hope that there will be second and third and fourth. Well, this is the first of only 2 hours on Dag Hammarskjöld's markings, and that's very, very limited in anybody's language. So will the introduction be limited. I just remind you that Hammarskjöld was quite successful in his time and honored in his time and subsequently Secretary General of the United Nations, and that sometime after his death, this personal journal of his was translated, well, it was published first in Swedish, and then translated and appeared in English, was a very popular sort of bedside book for a long, long time, has survived extremely well, and in the last 10 years has come out in at least 2 different paperback editions. I know because it's been a curse to me. I would find what was available for class in paperback, and I would send an order in for each successive term, and the point came when they said it's out of print. Another publisher had brought it up, and the second publisher had messed up all the pages. So I still have notes here, not tonight, I hope, but notes with a pagination from the earlier version that I had. And that made me work some more, and sometimes I completely lost references. But it's a good thing to realize that this classic is being regarded not just as a textbook, but that people are coming to find the riches of Hammarskjöld's thought in it. It is, as I say, a journal. If I had more time, I would push journal writing, because I think it's a very valuable thing. You can start it at any time in life. And one of the virtues of a journal over against a diary is that you don't get a journal book which has 5 lines to the day and you feel guilty, so you haven't enough things to feel guilty about already, if you don't find something to write there. The journal has, I think, as one of its basics, that you write sort of when you feel impelled, when there is something that you have either come to consider a particular question or problem for you personally, or when you have gained some insight that you want to write down before it slips away. That's my sort of thing. I think I would always find it very difficult to be very orderly about a journal, or about almost anything, or about a diary, I should say. A journal, and I have several fragments here and there. I even have something back in college days when I did not do it by a free option, but because my English 1 teacher said, "You will now write a journal." She transgressed my sense of the journal, and I sort of anticipated this, so I didn't spill the beans in my journal if she was going to read it. I think a journal ordinarily should be that which is for your eyes only. I have gone back to that occasion, and I've saved it in the midst of throwing away a lot of things. Everything but 40 years of income tax returns. And sometimes I congratulate myself that I had that insight, and sometimes I say, yeah, I was that dumb once, or, what did I ever write that for? But a journal should also have the ready accessibility of something that you can go back to, where you can compare sort of your thought today and your thought a month ago or even a year ago. Because very often what can happen then is that from juxtaposing those two elements or the question and answer, you can make some kind of modest progress in a deeper understanding. Much of this will be about understanding me. And here too, I am not in the business of espousing a great deal of introspection. Dear brother C.S. Lewis said at a rather advanced state in his religious quest that he learned to knock off a lot of interior dialogue. It's getting to be just too much. There is a point when we get so involved with ourselves that we do not engage with life, the world, those things that can not only keep our feet on the ground, but can keep our insights meaningful. To go off in cloud cuckoo land in our thoughts without this corrective is very hazardous. On the other hand, and that is some of the initial business of this evening and much of the business of markings, it is necessary that we ask those old questions. Who am I? Why do I do these things? What do I want to do? What is the purpose of my life? How am I relating to other people? All these questions. And that's where part of my announced topic comes in. Self-understanding, understanding the self. Questions of the ego, not from a strictly psychological point of view. You don't need to have two terms in psychology to follow, because if Hammarskjöld had them, his language certainly does not betray it. He is, in writing here, quite ordinary person in terms of the specifics of psychology and certainly of psychoanalysis. But he is extraordinary in the depth and intensity of his questioning. And now you see we've had two elements here that create, I think, significant interest in this material. Because on the one hand is a highly successful, highly regarded, just a world-renowned figure. And in his private realm, he has doubts about himself. He has questions. It's not that he is being a hypocrite, but he is able to function professionally at a very high level at the same time that there is some inner turmoil going on. The journal, as I say, was private. For some reason, before he died, he had left a note to a friend of his about the journal and had given clear permission that it should be published to our benefit. There are those who feel that Hammarskjöld himself had some wrong evaluations of this kind of introspection. There is the usual warning that I've already suggested. We may look at ourselves, whether at this moment or looking backwards, and be either overly kind or overly harsh about ourselves. One of the great figures when we are looking at spiritual autobiographies is St. Augustine. He is everybody's saint, so Lutherans don't have to be afraid of talking about St. Augustine. You can still have your hang-ups about whether to call the district president, the bishop, or Bill, but St. Augustine is so generally acknowledged among Catholics, Episcopalians, even among Lutherans, particularly because he was so much a teacher to Martin Luther. His own statement about his spiritual progression, which was wrapped about with a good deal of theological and biblical insight, was simply labeled the Confessions. And I've been amused unduly for years and years, because this has been a very popular paperback and I think has found its way into bookshelves, probably at airports, and I can just see the person who's hurrying through the airport when they want a book to read on the plane. There's nothing there. You never can get the latest magazines. Goes through and finds, the Confessions. I'll pay, how much is it? Then he opens up and finds what probably to the unenlightened is a dreary tale. Augustine was rather hard on himself. Looking back on his early life, he passed out the statement, I was a very great sinner for so small a boy. And that sort of reflects something of this overly extreme judgment. One of the examples that he gave was of what we would consider just boyish exuberance when he and some friends went over to the neighbor's orchard and stole some pears. It was not just the justice of God that the pears were not ripe and not very good. Augustine said, they weren't good, and he had better pears at home. Why did I steal them? And again, he's asking, what am I like? Why do I do things like that? He said it was just because they wanted to do something that they were not supposed to do. All the time, you find in people's histories, personal and general, that there is some basis to the matter of original sin, even if you call it by another name. We are like that. Now, with Hammarskjöld, I'm not making an explicit connection here with that kind of self-condemnation, childish sins, but there's still an awareness that motive has to be looked at very closely, and that sometimes motives show our weaknesses. On the other hand, then, we can be too kind to ourselves and justify ourselves in our actions. Here, too, I think probably Hammarskjöld is quite moderate. Many of his statements are rather ambiguous, so that in their form, they're generalized. It's not so much I and me and my, but we'll see some of these statements. General principles that he has thought through, but out of his own experience. W. H. Auden, who wrote the introduction to this, feels that Hammarskjöld had rather too high expectations of himself. Hammarskjöld made a statement that he knew himself better than anybody else. Auden takes exception to that. Well, quantitatively, I suppose you could make a case for Auden's judgment. On the other hand, I think we would all resent it if somebody said, well, you did this because of such and such. You say, how do you know that? How do you know what I'm thinking? Or clearly you were thinking this. I was, I wasn't. So you have to leave a certain leeway here and take the statements, make what you can of them. It is not essential that we come up with a truth factor on a scale of 1 to 10. But it's very stimulating, and we'll want to get on to get stimulated. The introduction points up that there are two major themes that concern Hammarskjöld in his markings. And here then, this is Auden's introduction, two themes come to preoccupy his thoughts. First, the conviction that no man can do properly what he is called upon to do in this life unless he can learn to forget his ego and act as an instrument of God. Second, that for him personally, the way to which he was called would lead to the cross, that is, to suffering, worldly humiliation, and the physical sacrifice of his life. Now that latter part, and we will be touching to some degree on that tomorrow when we talk about his spiritual Christian development more, is a remarkable thing. This element of sacrifice, which he sees as part of his family's tradition of service to humanity, comes from a notable family. His father had been, I believe, Prime Minister of Sweden. And before Dag became Secretary General, he had been in charge of economics or banking in Sweden. One of these phenomenal young men. But this was not just a matter of just, you know, following sort of the Kennedy tradition. You're a Kennedy, you do this and that, or any other name you might mention. If you're a Rockefeller, you obviously succeed in running banks. If you're Hammarskjöld, you serve humanity through government. There is the element of a willing sacrifice, a commitment to a task which may be thankless. And probably if we explored his career in the realm of economics, where I don't think that anybody is thanked very much, particularly our present day man managing the economy, whether they are administrators or in charge of the Fed or whatever it is, Hammarskjöld could attack these responsibilities with a sense of there was going to be some kind of self-giving, some kind of sacrifice. That meant also a tremendous outpouring of energies. Later on in the introduction, Auden talks about some of the last years, last months at least, of Hammarskjöld's life, when he was working 20 hours a day approximately and getting only 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. Some of you will remember how he was doing a sort of a diplomacy, shuttle diplomacy. He was doing a lot of traveling, and it was a very active role conceived of for the Secretary General. So he was putting out brush fires of insurrections and threats that might start another world war. In fact, it was on one of those that the plane in which he was being transported toward a new assignment crashed for reasons that have not been fully explained yet. And it is almost as though he had a premonition that he would die in service. Imagine that, you know, a desk job and you die at it. But of course, you leave the desk to go out and do field work. The element of sacrifice then is very important. But prior to that, of course, the first thing, one must learn to forget his ego. And here you have a problem, of course, that we would not have great people, we would not even have great saints, if we did not have large egos. Now that sounds like a very peculiar view of our humanity. And it sounds not at all egalitarian. But think of some of our great men and women of the Bible. Did anybody have a greater ego than David? Cross out, you know, his youthfulness. But when he gets to be king, he is the king. And that sort of thing can tip just a little too far, as in the case of Bathsheba. That is a demonstration of an ego that has broken its bonds. Here is an attractive woman. Her husband is off at war. He wants her. He takes her. And you know the rest of the sad tale, that he sees too that Uriah is killed off. And you've got a peculiar waffling here. I've said that David, in trying to cover his illicit relation with Bathsheba, is like the high school kid who gets his girlfriend pregnant and tries to wriggle out of it. Now, there's no question of an abortion with Bathsheba, but read that story again if you haven't. If you haven't heard developed, as the Bible is honest to say, he wanted Uriah killed, but still he wanted it possible that Uriah was really the father of the child that Bathsheba was carrying. It is ignoble, but there is an ego here. And without that ego, without that driving force, David could not have held those wild tribes together. There are other figures. Certainly, the prophets had to have a self-consciousness and a confidence so that they could stand up against kings in their time. Well, there was a simple prophet, not too well known, who came to David. There is a book of pictures that I have claimed at the library I should have turned over to me, because I have signed in so many times. I'm sort of like the fellow who has won the golf club medal 8 years in a row, and now I get it to keep. I say, give me this book. No one else looks at it. I take it out and show it to my classes, bring it back, and shuttle library loan. I'm intrigued by it. It's a book of paintings. I have trouble remembering the name of the painter. Sort of Rockwell Kentish, in a way. Rockwell, anyway. And it's called In Our Image. And they're marvelously good character studies of Old Testament figures. Much profounder than a lot of the Sunday school stuff, where you don't get any character, you just get sort of a stick image. Well, you can tell my friends at Augsburg that. I'll stand up to their faces. And the artists. And there's one magnificent scene. And here is the prophet who comes to David. Remember now, David is the powerful king. But he has given lots of credence to the rumors flying around about him, about Bathsheba and Uriah and all of that. And the prophet comes to him, and David is portrayed, he's sort of like this, you know, with the prophet leaning over him, about like the dentist, only he doesn't have the drill in hand. But David is looking up with the same apprehension. He's going to have his tooth pulled out, and he hasn't even had any anesthetic. And it's the moment when the prophet is saying to David, you are the man. He simply flattens him, or nails him to the wall, however you want to put it. The prophet had an ego along with David's. Now, this is not so evident or so dramatically evidenced in Hammarskjöld, but probably it helps us a little bit to appreciate it, and not necessarily to identify, but at least to say, well, I think I understand the kind of problem that he was experiencing in dealing with himself. There's another aspect here which comes in, and it is a particular way of looking at oneself. I don't want to try to interpret this ego struggle psychologically. There is an element that is sort of boggling to all psychology, because Hammarskjöld, well, his practical gifts, handling money and handling nations and doing diplomatic work, is really a Christian mystic. Paul was that. Paul talks many more times than we realize about how we are in Christ and Christ is in us. And Hammarskjöld picks up that language. God is in us. Again, Auden in the introduction says that's dangerous stuff. If you begin to say that God is in you, you get a power base that can be illicit. You are sort of say, God made me do it, no matter what it is. You've seen some of these cultists who are brought on stage and television sometimes, and they are sponsoring a community where there's a deep suspicion that children may even have died because they have been beaten unmercifully. And you get them, you know, just yielding a little bit of ground, but never quite saying that this is dubious. They have the Word of God, and they have a little bit of Scripture that if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. And in that enclosed community, they get by with it. If it is not a matter of simple murder, it is a matter of child abuse. But they are desperately right. And how do you get at that? How can even the civil authority move in and say, this is not God, this is of the devil? An ego can stand in the way, and a claim that God is somehow tied in with my ego and justifying it all can keep us not just barely out of heaven, but keep us so far removed from it that our devilishness is showing. We have then a man who has a strong ego. He is ambitious. And this, too, is a bad word. That is, he has not said, and he was certainly young when he came into the office, oh, I'm too young. I'm inadequate. No. And made the final no to this. There is the sense, I think I can do it. I heard a good friend of mine say, when he had been invited to become president of college after a short term in the ministry and some experience in teaching, you know, I accepted that challenge, and it wasn't very long after I got there before I discovered that I could do these things. I don't mean that that puts the college presidencies down low, but it says that some people have an ability, they ought to recognize it. We're not trying to say, you know, keep your sights low because God doesn't want you to accept any larger responsibilities. That's probably a harder responsibility, more difficult decision, than to keep going along, well, I can handle this, but, you know, anything more and it'd be beyond my task. Who knows what God has given us? So here, too, you have a problem not really dealt with, because there is amazingly little of the professional work of Hammarskjöld that spills over. We have some interesting statements of his. He spoke to the World Council of Churches meeting in Evanston. That's recorded. He spoke on, you remember Murrow's series, This I Believe. He made a marvelous succinct statement there of his faith. And yet there is a sense in which at the end of those days, and that's the only way you can see that he could get at this, he sat down for just a little while, put all of the problems of the office behind him, and got down to the business of Dag Hammarskjöld and God. So if you want to find out about his professional career, go to the books that have been written about that. But this is about Hammarskjöld himself. There's another interesting comment. Auden was a poet and appreciated the fact that Hammarskjöld had written a fair amount of poetry. Oh, this is another thing about doing your own writing of poetry. Many of you have felt that, you know, you had the urge, but you certainly weren't going to disclose this. So a journal is a way you can do that just for yourself. You shouldn't even do little funny things. I apologize for the way I started this evening. But there's something important in this poetry, at least as far as Auden sees it, and that is that he felt the poetry is an indication that Hammarskjöld had achieved a serenity of mind at that point. Now, that seems to make poetry just a sort of pale reflection of the resolution of problems, and I don't think it's that. Poetry has passion in it, and very often, like the cries of lament in the Psalms, you get the sense that the psalmist is still in the throes of this questioning of God. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from hearing me? Along with the final part of every one of those psalms of lament, I still believe in God.
But there is a progression, and it takes reading over the space of all the pages and all the years of Hammarskjöld's markings to see that. It is not as though he comes to an absolute state of perfect rest and serenity. But the title for tomorrow's session at 4 o'clock, I remind you, is concerning the saying yes, and it's one of the key ideas in the whole of the collection. That at some time and to someone I said yes, and from that time on, life had a meaning. The earlier writing is very troubled. He says very frankly that when he was younger and as he was writing these early pages, what he asked he thought was impossible, that life could have a meaning. That sounds strange, because he was committed to something. He was committed to world peace. He had a great vision, and he is doing something. He is being applauded, at least in much of the world, but he gets back to his home and to his pet monkey, called a ridiculous thing, and he says, I'm doing all this, but it doesn't satisfy. I don't have any meaning. I remember every so often hearing about ministry to the up and outers. And sometimes the church was called to minister in a special way to those who were successful. We thought, why them? You know, they weren't feeling any need. They were probably attending a church and doing everything. And somebody said, yes, but are you sure that they have really found a meaning? And I guess here the argument is from the greater to the smaller. If there can be people like that who find that all of their efforts are so meaningless, then we have to realize that there's an awful lot of emptiness. There are an awful lot of frustrated lives going on around us. How do you get at them? Well, not by saying, is life meaningful to you? But rather sometimes waiting until people come and say, probably because they can say to you, you know, you've impressed me. You seem to know what life is about. You've had some hardships, and yet you handle them. I don't see how you can do it. My life is nothing. People look at me and say, you must be very happy. You're very grateful. You just added two more garages onto your house, didn't you? You got five now. Where is the unhappiness? Where is the frustration? Where is the lack of meaning? With Hammarskjöld, it was there even at his high level. Somehow we feel that the higher you get, the more meaning we find. Now, to get at some of Hammarskjöld's own explicit words, let me go, and this will come mainly out of the earlier statement, because Hammarskjöld did not bother to date all of these things. There had been some guesstimation done, but the dating here is from 1925 to 1930. And you see, he is thinking about the ego question. What you have to attempt to be yourself, what you have to pray for, to become a mirror in which, according to the degree of purity of heart you have obtained, the greatness of life will be reflected. Especially here, to attempt to be yourself and to pray for. I tied in here in a different way from my pursuit of this last week. I don't have the best memory, but every so often I get a sense. Was that yesterday that I talked about that? It was the last part of last week, and so I'm a little apprehensive. But this week, I said we would deal not only with the matter of the ego, but with the wisdom of Hammarskjöld. Premature in a way, although it has not all come after the sense of meaning. And here, then, in one of these early statements, I think there is great wisdom. Every deed and every relationship is surrounded by an atmosphere of silence. Friendship needs no words. It is solitude delivered from the anguish of loneliness. That's, you know, a nice sort of calendar statement, Poor Richard's Almanac. There is another emphasis on silence, which is more religious and seems therefore more fitting, where Hammarskjöld writes, we keep talking to God, and we expect him to listen, but we don't listen for the answer. And that's sort of a commonplace when we do bother to talk much about prayer, which we don't do much because it's too much of a condemnation of our practice. Prayer is not simply crying out to God, it is listening. And that means being quiet. And that means waiting. Keeping the way open. And not tickling the phone and saying, "Hey, are you there?" God doesn't speak to us in that way. He is not conversational, probably. But the silence, and the silence that can come when you sit with paper and pencil before you and are writing, Hammarskjöld knew could be a moment in which God had his turn to speak. There are several references here that I will not cite specifically now, because I'd be turning pages too much, where you get a sense of the kinds of para-professional things that he was called on to do. By that I mean go to receptions, engage in sort of cocktail talk. He sees through it. It's empty. It is form. And there are no silences there. People are chattering. Who's listening? Nobody. They're just all talking. And there's no time to hear what other people are thinking, certainly not what they're feeling. I like that parody of this kind of talk where two people meet and the first says, "Hi, how are you? How are things going?" "Oh, fine, I just killed my mother-in-law." "Oh, isn't that nice?" Do we hear one another? The commitment that Hammarskjöld is working on is not just commitment to the job, it's the commitment to people. And whether it is in the relationship of friendship, you listen. Or in religion, you listen. And friendship, of course, goes beyond this to where you do not have to talk all the time. I have felt sometimes when people have talked about the relationship of marriage and communication, very guilty, because there was not a constant exchange of words. I think, I hope there were enough. But we were not at odds with one another when we were not talking. In fact, sometimes we were stopped from talking because when we started talking, we said the same thing. We were exactly on the same idea. We can be at ease with friends. We do not have to chatter. and keep the conversation going. I think some of the communication problem we have is that there is too much talk and not enough listening. And here again, and this gets into a different realm, this goes all over. Don't blame me if this is spotty, because that's Hammershawed all over. Life only demands from you the strength you possess. Only one feat is possible, not to have run away. That, too, is typical of much of this early literature. And there are some good reminders to people who are hiking up Holden Trails, where he will say, don't be looking up or down, just keep going. I think I may come on that if I'm lucky, but I'm not always lucky on these things. Page 9. Now, this I have to start with, as I keep it in the page sequence here. And here you have motivation again. Praise nauseates you, but woe betide him who does not recognize your worth. You've heard the people who say tongue-in-cheek that I can't be flattered easily, but, you know, try it. Another one. You cannot play with the animal in you without becoming wholly animal. Play with falsehood without forfeiting your right to truth. Play with cruelty without losing your sensitivity of mind. He who wants to keep his garden tidy doesn't reserve a plot for weeds. It is a highly moral, if not moralistic, outlook. And it has, again, this introspective character. Why are you doing this? What will result? Again, if you don't speak ill of others more often than you do, this certainly isn't from any lack of desire. But you know that malice only gives you elbow room when dispensed in carefully measured doses. In other words, if you're going to be nasty, don't be too nasty. A little bit of it gives you a sort of character. But if you become a real curmudgeon, then people say you are inconsiderate. Here is, again, an insight into a topic, and I dealt with it a little more fully last week. There's not a morbid preoccupation with death, but there is a genuine inquiry and a much more profound questioning of the meaning of death in Hammershaw than in a lot of religious writings. Here is one paragraph. She knew more that there could never be a way out, because behind all this talk of freedom lay hidden a child's wish to conquer death, a lack of interest in any piece of work, the result of which would not be his, even long after he was dead. A child's wish to hang on to something, not property, not even life itself, but something that would be yours. It makes us aware that here is some deep insight into why we don't like the threat of death. Besides cutting us off, no longer are we going to have the satisfaction of having people say, you have done well. Or, you did this, didn't you? I remember this. We're going to miss out on all that. A child's wish to hang on to this. It's, I think, almost more insidious than trying to gather up riches and find place in the casket for that. We know that doesn't work, but still keep working at this. We haven't quite completed something that will be worthy of putting on our gravestone. Sometimes there might be things that somebody else will put there, but if we worked so hard to get that particular designation there, it probably is all spoiled. I love to think of the stone. I think it is in Ålesund, in Norway. The man who at least gave us the music for that Christmas hymn, Jeg så glad ved julekveld, I am so glad, and simply says there, so and so, died. He gave us Jeg så glad. I'm sure he did other things, and he probably thought that wasn't going to last. And yet, people said that was his. But to say, now, what have I done? Get panicky and say, how are they going to remember me? child's wish. There's another place in which Hammarskjöld talks about dying well. He sees the example and he talks about some instances of suicide, and clearly he feels that there has been a denial of life and a non-well dying. Go on to something else. Imagery that corroborates what I said a bit ago about the kind of cocktail party language. A blown egg floats well and sails well on every puff of wind, light enough for such performances since it has become nothing but shell, with neither embryo nor nourishment for its growth. And then he seems to jump over to something else. He puts in quotation marks, a good mixer. All of the schools that are going on, you know, tell the salesmen and to tell the preachers and to tell this and that, how to be good mixers, how to come in and, you know, just welcome everybody. Hammarskjöld puts it alongside, you know, an egg you're going to use for Easter decoration, and you punch a hole in each end and blow out the egg white. That's not so bad. But how you ever get the yolk out? Never worked for me. But until it's all empty, and then you put wax on the ends, and you've got that lovely shell, and you can put beautiful colors on it. That's a good mixture. Without reserve or respect for privacy, anxious to please, speech without form, words without weight, mere shells. That's damning. I'm not sure. There are some references here that make me wonder about some of the things that Hammarskjöld read. About this time, T.S. Eliot was writing, and he had some biting criticism of society. And he talked about the cocktail parties, and he talked about society. It made a noise like rats running over broken glass. Wasn't he the one that said, too, something about, you know, our age that would... be remembered when the archaeologists came along, they would find millions of lost golf balls as a commentary on our time. Pardon?
For all my husbands.
I don't want to get into family arguments. This matter of individuality comes in, and of course that's part of the ego. It's something that God has given us. We've heard, I think Susan has pointed this out in her Bible studies earlier, baptism, we are given a name. That's a name that God knows. It's a name that, you know, to put it in picture language, God has entered into his book of life. We are individuals. Here is what Hammarskjöld says. Why this desire in all of us that after we have disappeared, the thoughts of the living shall now and again dwell upon our name, anonymous immortality we cannot even escape. The consequences of our lives and actions can no more be erased than they can be identified and duly labeled to our honor or our shame. That's part of it. There is also elsewhere, and I don't have it noted adequately here, the encouragement. Be yourself. Don't follow the crowds. Don't, be a this or a that. Years ago, I have a recollection of some tongue-in-cheek statement about a young nonconformist. I am an individualist, a nonconformist, after the model of Marlon Brando. Huh? What is your name? Who are you? And a bit more in the realm of wisdom. Hammarskjöld was fond of these wise statements. There is one that is cited by Auden in the beginning, where he talks about the road to holiness is through action. Now that, too, complicates this idea. I talked about Hammarskjöld as the mystic, and our usual sense of the mystic is somebody who can sit with legs crossed and arms folded for 24 hours at a time without saying anything, and that's the stance. And we have an appeal of that sort of thing, not an extreme, but we should be able just to sit and meditate. Hammarskjöld obviously meditated, but he says also, how do we develop through action? You don't conceive of of a Teresa, Sister Teresa, or Mother Teresa, I guess it is, as saying, well, just send all those people home. I've done my stint for a day, and I simply must pray. I think she, I've encouraged in others following her as in herself. This is the way of meditation. This is the way of understanding. And that, again, is one thing you don't just apply artificially. Here is that listening to God that I want to cite, and then we are just about up to my appointed time. There may be time for a little bit of comment. How can you expect to keep your powers of hearing when you never want to listen? That God should have time for you, you seem to take as much for granted as that you cannot have time for him. You know, again, at the risk of being misunderstood, I told the waiter, whoever she was, that had the matins the other day, I did one of the finest that I'd had all week, because she said, it's time to be silent. And so it wasn't just a moment of silence before we sang our prayer, but it was a good long hunk. And this is not a condemnation of spoken matins or vespers. I talked enough to Monday evening. Didn't give you much chance to listen. But to recognize, as I said before, we must learn to listen. And I think that's one of the virtues here. Schedule's not so tight, but what we can go somewhere, do something, where things are quiet, and we can listen. That's where some of the wisdom comes from here.